Dick Anderson, and I'm an alcoholic. And if you would, join me, we'll open with a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Thank you. This session is going to be on traditions, and it's going to be on traditions. It's not going to be a three-hour a session, it's going to be more like an hour, so you get out of here in time to enjoy some things, because that's about all the time that what I've got to say can be said in that time frame. But a lot of people, and you can tell by the attendance, that more people think that the steps are more important than the traditions. That's not what our literature tells us, but there's a reason for that, because the recovery and the steps are always about me, and the traditions are about other people. And our alcoholic personalities want to work on me and not other people. But I got a question for you. How many people in here have had a drink during the last year? Okay, a few hands. Then recovery is what you want to be working on. How many people in here have had trouble with a relationship anywhere during the last year? Then the traditions are what you want to be working on. This is the most underused set of tools in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason for that is people come in, they work through recovery, they grab onto it, they get sober. But here's what happens when you get sober. I talked about it last night. Once I have recovered, and the big book says I have recovered, and there'll come a time, even for those of you who've had a drink in the last year, if you work through these steps thoroughly, that desire will be taken away from you. And I have not had a desire in almost 27 years. So alcohol is no longer a problem. I am recovered from that so long as I continue to stay active in the fellowship of AA. But as soon as I get sober, now I've got to do something with me. And that's where I have to start dealing with other people. And that's the area in which alcoholics are not too good. And the traditions were written in the beginning so that we could learn how to stay united in our fellowship. But I was taught the traditions by the old timers as a way of dealing with my relationships, dealing with life, dealing with work, dealing with anybody where I had to step outside of myself. When you look at the 12 and 12, and my home group that I mentioned last night was a men's group, and it was a men's 12 and 12 group. It says, a co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous tells how members recover and how the society functions. But in essence, it's how society functions in general, and that's what I didn't know. I was so self-centered in the way I handled most things, I did not know how to get along with most people. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the history, where they come from, how we got the traditions, and why we need them. And I think we just went over why we need them when we looked at all those hands. The first reason, most people think that we don't need them because we all identify with each other, and we all have the same backgrounds. So let's see how well we identify. How many people in here went to jail shortly after their first drink when they were 14? Two guys. How many people in here were locked up at their senior prom and put in a felony tank for assault and battery with seven Black Panthers? Keith told me I forgot to tell that last night, but I was locked up at my senior prom for two counts of assault and battery on a police officer, and they didn't throw me in the drunk tank. They threw me in the felon tank because I was 18 and I'd hit a cop. So they put me in the tanks had bunks for eight people, and the other seven cellmates were Black Panthers who were in Louisville to disrupt the Kentucky Derby, something else we have at prom time. And there were seven Black Panthers in there, and me and my little powder blue tuxedo jacket. I learned very quickly about race relations. Okay, and how many people, I know this is one we'll get a lot of, how many people have accidentally picked up a guy in a dress? So our common experiences are not all that common. I've heard lots of stories, and the circumstances under which people get here are very, very different. The families they come from are very, very different. So our unity can't depend upon likeness. It can't depend upon having the same accents or being from the same religion. So something else has to unify us. And at the core of everything in our traditions is unity. It's the first tradition, but it is the core for all that we do. Now, how many people know what is the most successful, fastest growing recovery group in the United States for alcoholism? It was the Washingtonians. The Washingtonians started in Baltimore in a tavern called Chase's Tavern in the year 1840, when alcohol was a major problem and lots of people were drinking. And six drunks were sitting around and having a conversation, probably like we drunks do, trying to figure out where they had parked their horse the night before. And enough was enough, and these six guys decided they wanted to get sober. And they just made a band and a covenant with each other that they would help each other to stay sober. And they did. And they helped others to stay sober. And within 3 years, there were 100,000 members of the Washingtonians. That's at a time when our country was only 17 million people. That would be like AA going from scratch in 1935 when Dr. Bob and Bill met, to over 2 million people before the Big Book was written. And in fact, it took until 1940 to get the first 100 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. By 1860, that same movement that had been growing so quickly had vanished, and there were no more members of the Washingtonians. And so when these traditions were written in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were written and produced for 1946, so just 11 years into our fellowship, we had the traditions. They were confirmed and accepted at our first international conference in Cleveland in 1950. They were born out of an awareness of what took place with the Washingtonians and why they failed, coupled with our experience over that first 15 years. And mostly what we learned was how to do it wrong, and the traditions helped us to keep unified and to keep a singleness of purpose. And most of all, it put into what I think is beautiful about the traditions, it helps, is that AA recognizes not only what can happen if we become spiritually minded, but it also takes into account our flesh. It takes into account our human nature, what we normally do. And these are made to prevent us from having our human nature run this program. So, I'm going to read, this is one of the things that we're having a little bit of a problem with in Alcoholics Anonymous now, but this is from a 1945 article written in the Grapevine, and there was some great concern at that point, and this is called a fatal omission. The Washingtonian movement might have survived, however, might have triumphed over its mistakes and its enemies and well-wishers, except for one fatal omission. Its organizers believed they could get along without a higher power. It wasn't a particularly religious time, and inebriates, then as now, had generally lost touch with him. Many of them, in fact, were outspoken in their denunciations of all of his works, especially as demonstrated in the activities and attitudes of so-called Christian folk. The meetings of the society's groups were conducted usually without reference to him. Washingtonians were not atheists. It just hadn't occurred to them that God, as we understood him, could help them to stay sober. In fact, some of them believed that if they invited God to their councils, sectarianism also would push its way in and their movement would be taken over by one or another of the churches. The society was not on God's side, and consequently, it disintegrated. I just came from, and I travel a lot, and when I'm out on the road, I go to meetings. I went to a meeting in Maryland about 2 weeks ago. I walked in, I didn't know anybody. Neither did any of the new people that walked in. It was a discussion meeting. It was supposed to be on the steps. And the discussion was on the first step. And after there was a brief reading about the first step, they went around the room, and the guy picked people. Six people got to speak. And out of those six people, five of them had had a drink in the last 30 to 60 days. They sat and told about all the problems they had, why things weren't working, and they gave a pretty gloomy picture of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I had been a new member, I would not have gone back because I didn't see a solution. And our first tradition is about unity, except as it affects AA as a whole. And what happens is when I go to a meeting, and I find that I'm at this meeting and cannot get any kind of solution. I don't get fed at all, and I'm a newcomer. I'm not going to come back. Last year, we buried my cousin, who was a couple years younger than me, a Vietnam veteran, had made it through a career. He was alcoholic, and because he knew that I was in AA, he started going to meetings. And I know where he went to meetings, in a place where they don't have much in the way of solutions. And all he heard were a bunch of people complaining about their problems. And he decided that there was nothing here in AA for him. Now, if he had wanted to bad enough, he might have found it. We can say that. But we didn't offer it to him through those meetings that we gave it to him. There is no guarantee that Alcoholics Anonymous will be around for another 20 or 30 years. There is no guarantee that we will continue to have any kind of singleness of purpose unless we do, in fact, follow these traditions. That's the main reason we discuss them. But I'm going to go through each one of them just briefly. This meeting is going to last maybe 45 minutes or an hour, and go over why, in effect, these things work in our personal life. It's not a self-help buddy program. We know that it's a program spiritual in nature. That's told to us in the Big Book. What I'm going to do is read the... In this book, there is the short version that we know, and there's also a long version. I'm going to read the long version, I'm going to read the short version, and then I'm going to read what it was told, what it means to me. The long form of Tradition 1. Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of a great whole. AA must continue to live, or most of us will surely die. That's about as declarative as it gets. The only other place in there I know that is as declarative in the Big Book is... about resentments, where it says about taking our fourth step. It says if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. Here, A must continue to live or most of us will surely die. Hence, our common welfare comes first, but individual welfare follows close afterward. The short version, which you're more used to hearing, is we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Well, let's try the concepts. Let me try the... Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. And the way that was explained to me in my personal life is that put us first and not me first. And I had spent my whole life putting me first, and I didn't know how to do anything about that until I got through recovery. But after I got through recovery, I became an active member. I was there taking as much as I could in the very beginning. I was the ashtray guy, so I did have a job. But I didn't know how this functioned. I didn't know how to be of any help. I wasn't involved in any kind of committee or anything like that. I didn't have a relationship. I'd lost that. So I lived kind of on an island unto myself, even though all these people were helping me. But part of the blessing was that as I started to get sober and started to meet people and started to have relationships and started to have a job, I needed to find out exactly how to act with other people. Barbara and I told you last night, Barbara and I met when I was doing a ninth step to a church. We've been married for 20 years now. And some of the lessons that I've learned, I've actually learned from her. And I'll tell you a story, how she has a saying that's called, how important is it when I'm putting other people first, when I'm getting me out of the way in a relationship? When Barbara and I were first married, we went through a period where we were kind of surprised at each other, and she was a little bit younger than me, had never been involved in a relationship, never lived with anybody before, had always lived at home or school or graduate school or wherever. And so she had never lived around a guy, and she could not get over the fact that I would not put the toilet seat down. Now, this was no big deal to me, because I was used to living by myself for a long time, so I'd leave the toilet seat up, so I didn't think anything about it. Barbara would call her sponsor. She'll tell you the story. She called her sponsor. She'd say, he leaves the toilet seat up again. Her sponsor says, that's his business. Don't worry about it. She called again. About the fourth or fifth time that Barbara brings it up with her sponsor says, okay, I'm tired of hearing about this. You're going to take some action. I want you, instead of griping about him leaving the toilet seat up, you put the toilet, or leaving the toilet seat, up, that when you get through using the toilet, you put it up for him, rather than waiting for him to put it down for you. Barbara said, you're crazy. And so for a month, my wife took the toilet seat every time she got through using the toilet and put it up. It took me at least 1 month before I figured out what she was doing, and I even noticed the difference. The point is, once that was done and we laughed about it, it was over. It wasn't the issue of the toilet seat. And it's just like Keith talked about with the knives earlier today. That toilet seat was a sticky issue with us. We were getting very angry at each other. But the importance was that us came before me. And she took the action, the unselfish action, of giving in to whatever I was doing. Loving each other first, putting each other first. And I've followed men that do this. I can tell you that on my 25th AA birthday, I had a couple of guys speak that I follow. And both of them have been men that have sponsored me over the years. And one was a guy named Bill R. from over in our area. And Bill spoke about the fact that when he was 17 years sober, he was trying to figure out how to have an affair, how to get rid of his marriage so he could have an affair with another woman. And now he was sitting there that night with 46 years of sobriety with the wife that he would have divorced, blessed because he was able to change her diapers because she has Alzheimer's. And he considers it an honor to be able to be with her and to care for her and nurture her. Because at some point, Bill realized that us was more important than me. And in the doing of that, he got a relationship. He got a commitment. More than just, is this working out? And that's the kind of guys that I follow, and that's why I follow him. My other sponsor was there. My other sponsor had been kind of a 13th stepper for a while. It seems like in my early days of AA, whenever I went out with anybody, they had either gone out with him or another fellow named Conway, and this guy's name was John, and John was a good-looking guy, and he had trouble with relationships. And at some point, he had to realize that us was more important than me. And when he took that step, he married Mary Emma. My sponsor's named John Holmes. He's been married to Mary Emma for 20 years. John's got 46 years. Because he taught me that putting the relationship first was what was going to keep it alive. This works for me in another areas. I have a client that I acquired about 2 years ago. And the client and I at first thought I wasn't going to be able to work out with. I mentioned that I was sick about 2.5 years ago. What I didn't mention was, in addition to the problems I had at the hospital, because I was so sick, I had 3 strokes. And I had a lot of difficulty in being able to read and being able to do some of the things I did. I didn't tell anybody because I was afraid if people knew that, nobody would hire me. And so I kind of kept that a secret. And I had a very bad year or so. And I had to take on a new client. And this new client was someone, it was a smaller company, and it was kind of a humbling job for me, but it paid me something on the first of each month. And I had learned from my sponsors and learned from this fellowship that there's no such thing as pride, and I needed some income because the set of circumstances that I ran up against for this were, one, we had 9/11. Right before that, we had a recession, and within 3 weeks of 9/11, I was in the hospital, almost died, had 3 strokes, and I went from being in a fairly comfortable position because of circumstances to a position where I couldn't make my house payments. The honorable thing to do, and we are self-supporting, is to go to work, and I found a client, and the client was somebody who would pay me a monthly fee at the beginning of each month. But he wasn't used to working with somebody who had worked in the areas that I'd worked in. And so sometimes he treated me like kind of a low-end employee. Well, that's my own pride that got in the way. And so what I had to make a decision to do was put us first, put my work with him first, and not take what he said to me personally. As a result, he and I are very good friends now. Without me asking, he raised what he paid me by double. And the reason for this is he saw in me the ability to work, to do a good job for him. He would tell me what to do on many occasions in almost a condescending manner. I would do it. I would make recommendations, but I would do what I agreed to do in the first place rather than having to be right, rather than having to be the one that showed him what I knew. I've got 3 Clios. You know, that would have been my attitude in the old days. Instead, when I show up at the trade show, which I've designed something for, and he wants me to be there and unbox things and put carpet down, which is not something I've ever done, I did it because he was paying me a fee. He no longer asks me to do things like that because he realizes where I've got talent and where it can better be used. But he gave me, doubled my fee in the meantime, and he and I are now praying together about his business, and he has been talking to me about running his business in spiritual principles, and it turned out that he was a guy where he was making a commitment to God at the same time. He doesn't have a drinking problem, but he was trying to learn how to live with these principles at the same time. If I had been right or argued with him, I would have done two things. I would have lost that fee and wouldn't have been able to pay my bills, and two, I would have missed the opportunity to be of help, of service to him. The big book says our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. I would have missed that had I been right. It wasn't that I had to say, I don't know what I'm doing. But I was there to help him, and I didn't have to be a big shot about it. So unity takes a lot of forms. Our second tradition in the short version is, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. And the long form of that is, exactly the same. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Couldn't really expand on that too much. And what this says to me is that there's one authority, there are no big shots. Not only here, but elsewhere. Barbara and I, in order to stay married over this period of time, have had to learn how to disagree with each other. And there have been quite a few times when we've had some major arguments about how we were going to handle things. And usually it had to do with finances, or it had to do with how we were going to take some of our resources and use them in some way. And other occasions, other decisions that we had to make about where we were going to live or what we were going to do. But when we absolutely cannot agree and get to the point where I'd be so angry I'd feel like throwing something at her, we agreed early on before we even got married that we'd do this because it was passed along to me by one of the old-timers in Louisville. When she and I disagree to that point, we'll stop, hold hands, pray, turn it over to God, and walk away from it. I believe that's the single most important reason why we're still married and still love each other after all this time. I can't think of anything that we've ever had an argument about, including finances, including anything else, where having turned it over to God, it didn't solve itself at some point. And Barbara and I were laughing about it the other day. When we think back on the issues that we've argued about, we can't really remember what they were, because when we turned them over to God, a solution came in time. And we weren't working on each other. We were working on being a couple, being purposeful. Keith was talking about writing out the purpose. You know, it tells us what our purpose is, to fit ourselves to be a maximum service to God and the people about us. But we have a purpose in marriage. Our purpose is to nurture each other, to create a home for each other, to create. We don't have any kids. So in our case, that's not part of the purpose. We got married late. But it's to nurture each other, to care for each other. And that was never more evident than 2.5 years ago when I was in that hospital room. And if I hadn't been married, I'd have been by myself. But instead, Barbara was in there when I was in critical condition, sleeping in a chair around the clock for 3 weeks. And my sister and my brother, whom I had made amends to, who I disagreed with a lot in the past, were down here sleeping in a chair because we were more important than me. And because I had learned to have a relationship. For years I thought it was up to me. I've got the kind of personality where I thought it was up to me to run things. What I do is write and direct, produce. I played quarterback. Almost every position I've ever had has been one where I was involved in decision making, allocating how other people would do things. That is not how you lead. I've learned that the hard way over a number of years. There is no authority except God, which means when I'm trying to be of leadership, even if I'm working with people in a film project, my job is to pull out the best of each of them, because God has given each of them some talent, some knowledge, and I may have a vision about where we're supposed to go, but my job is really to be the coordinator of their talents. Right now I'm serving in a service position, which I did not, I was really trying to be archivist a couple of years ago, and somebody asked me to stand for this position, and now I'm delegate in Georgia. And as such, I get a lot of people that will come to me and ask me questions as though I'm supposed to solve a problem for them. And what I've had to learn to do is not give them a direct answer. I give them the best information I can, saying, on one hand, this makes sense. On the other hand, this makes sense. And I think a good group conscience will give you the verdict, and good luck. Because it's not my job to dictate what they do in their group. It's not my job to dictate what they do anyplace else. And I've had to learn to get me out of the way. I learned this lesson on my first pigeon, a guy named Al B, who looks remarkably like Dr. Bob. Any of that Roanoke group still here? Okay. Doesn't Al look like Dr. Bob? Anyway, he was my first pigeon, and he was assigned to me. And I worked as hard as I could to get him sober. And I explained everything about the program, and I read to him out of the book, and I did everything I could for Al. And Al would continue to go back out and drink. And I'd get irritated, and Al would continue to go back out and drink. And I'd get more irritated, and I couldn't understand why he didn't understand what I was telling him, this gift that I was giving him. Finally, Al's father called me, and he was crying. He said, Al got drunk again, and I don't know what to do. And I said, well, Mr. B, if I had a job, and I was vice president of my dad's company, I had a car, and I had credit cards, and I had all this, and I could go out and get drunk and come back and still have my position, I'd still be drinking too. So Al's father fired him the next day. Al got sober 2 days later. He's been sober ever since. He just celebrated 25 years, and he's a fine member. I had absolutely nothing to do with that. God had something to do with it. And that was the lesson that I had to learn in all of my life. There's one authority, and we don't have big shots. The third tradition, the only requirement for AA as membership is a desire to stop drinking. The short version of that is we don't judge motives. If anybody had tried to judge my motive when I was working any of the steps in the beginning, I would not have made it because my motives weren't pure. I was working most of the steps so I could get something. When I made an amends, it was because I thought I was going to get something out of it. I wasn't genuinely accepting responsibility for my actions until I was almost halfway through my ninth step. Because I was trying to do something for me because you told me that's what I needed to do. I told last night about the situation where I went to Hartmus, who was the comptroller for this company. And if I had judged her motives, I would not have made this amend because I was absolutely sure I was going to prison. And instead, she was the woman that, when I tried to make amends and told her I had stolen $30,000 from this company, told me that there were a group of people who had been praying for me, and they forgave that debt. I would never have guessed that. But that was because I was doing what God asked me to do, and I'm glad I did not judge her motives. The story that I told last night about that Catholic priest, if there were two groups that I resented the most in religion, it were the Baptists, that's where I went to church, and the Catholics, because I was around a lot of Catholics. And I just resented these rules, and I hated all of the rules. That Catholic priest gave me the gift of a lifetime, and I shared it with you last night, how to identify God's will. In a gentle and merciful way, I could understand the story about the two kids with the red wagon in a way when I could not understand anything that anybody else told me. And it stuck with me to this day and allowed me to do one day at a time, accept what God gives me, and use it the best I can to be of help to somebody else. When I was about 3 or 4 years sober, I was dealing with lust. And there was a group that I felt really intolerant of about sexual conversations. It was the Baptist Church. And because of that, I guess through some kind of wisdom, my sponsor said, you need to go ask your pastor about that. Keith talked about that earlier. Because I was so afraid of judgment, I was so afraid that somebody was going to hit me. I was so afraid I was going to be punished. I was so afraid I was going to be embarrassed. I was so afraid I was going to be told that I was no good. And I go to this Baptist minister who was the same minister at the church I grew up in as a child, was still there. And I told him what I was there for, and he said, he didn't give me any judgment. He said, let's pray. I had the most significant spiritual experience of my life that day. While he and I knelt in prayer, this tremendous undulation and light came into the room. And it was so powerful and so awesome that I was afraid to open my eyes. And there was a smell almost like fresh flowers. And I've read about these kind of experiences since then, but I'd never heard of one before that. And I was absolutely awestruck and couldn't open my eyes and didn't know what to do. And when I got through, this pastor had felt the same experience. And I said, what does that mean? He said, I don't know, but God sent you a message. All my life I'd been around rules and regulations and military and you thou shalt not and you cannot and so forth. But what happened in this case, because I was willing not to judge the motives of this Baptist preacher and to go and ask for his help, I was given this glimpse, this feel of the awesome power of God as a heavenly father. 2 days later, I was in a mall, and there were a couple of good-looking babes walking across, and I was sexualizing them, and I was thinking about, I used to watch girls and think what it'd be like to have sex with them, and that's how I would spend my time in the mall. These two girls walk in front of me, and the thought went through my mind that when I went out with a girl whose family I did not know, I could be fairly aggressive. When I went out with a girl whose father I knew and respected, I would respect that girl. And because of that, I suddenly got the picture. This power that I had felt just a little bit of, that was so awesome, was the heavenly father of all these girls. She was a child of God. And there's not one woman on this planet that I don't need to treat with respect for her father. And if I'm asking her father to give me the power to stay sober, and the power to find a good and useful life, and the power to have a wife, and the power to overcome disease 2.5 years ago, and the power to do all of the things that I asked for, how can I go to that father in good faith while I'm disrespecting his daughters? And that was a gentle, kind way for God to give me that lesson. I never would have gotten that lesson if I had judged the motives of this pastor that I was going to. Me prejudging people has always been a problem. I know what they're going to say before I ask them. And in each of these cases, I found out that wasn't true. The fourth tradition, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Independent, yes, but only to a point. Individual freedom ends when it threatens us, when it threatens our unity. In 1999, I was doing a film up in Akron called House Full of Miracles, and I'd been asked to do this, and we went up, and I was prepping the film. And I had been to Founders Day in 1978. And in 1978, it was like going back to the mother church of AA, and everybody was respectful, and they were wearing coats and ties, and all the old-timers were up there, and it was a tremendous experience. And it was like learning about the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started talking to different people around town because we were going to shoot in a lot of different places. And I said, we're going to premiere this over Founders Day. And they said, oh, no, Founders Day, we leave town. A lot of them come into town, they make a lot of noise, they're up all night, and they trash the place. Now, if I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I go to a conference, and I'm up all night making a lot of noise, and I trash the place. If we did that here, and we leave this place trashed, if only one person who would know that we were Alcoholics Anonymous would say, I don't want to be any part of them, we've just killed somebody. So our independence and how we have our meetings, just like that meeting in Maryland that I mentioned, ends when it affects other people and when it affects how people think of AA as a whole. Tradition 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And in my life, that's what is my primary purpose? What's our primary purpose? Stay focused. In my family, what's our primary purpose? And it's like Keith talking about earlier, we write down what our family's purpose is. What are we to do? We nurture each other. We care for each other. We support each other. We offer unconditional love when you get banged up at work, when you get banged up by relatives, when things happen. Barbara's going through a tough time right now. We had to make a decision that we were going to stay in the Atlanta area. This is before I got involved in the service position that I'm in now. But we were thinking about moving over to North Carolina. But we made a decision to stay here because her mother and father need our help. That's God's will. She's the caretaker for her mom and dad, and they were getting to the point where they need some help, and sometimes they're difficult to deal with. But we need to offer them unconditional love, and what we do in our relationship with each other is we're absolutely supportive. If she has a problem someplace, if she has a problem with her mother, if she has a problem at work, she works at a treatment center for alcoholic doctors, and some of them can be pretty tough to deal with. And she does a lot of good for people. But every day is not a good day, and I need to be there to be supportive for her. That's our purpose, to support each other, to give a cradle, to give a family, to give safe harbor from what takes place outside. That's the reason for our family. It's not just so we can have a good time. We do have a lot of good times. We travel. She loves the program. This girl that I was engaged to that I talked about, that I broke up with, my inclination was to, when I thought that I wanted to make amends to her, that was to get back with her because I still had the hots for her after I got sober. My sponsor says, that's not how we make amends. What's your primary purpose? Your purpose is to be of help to her. And because of that, I did not try to go get her. I just made my amends. I did the things I needed to. I was polite. I kept at a distance. I shared with her from my heart how sorry I was for many of the things I did. And because of that, when the time came, she accepted that amends. When the time came, she did call me, and her husband had a drinking problem, and I was able to help her get to Al-Anon, and their family now has been sober and members of the fellowship for 18 years. And that wouldn't have happened had I not remembered my purpose. In the big book, there's not one good thing that comes to us without us having a purpose in the first place. This is about taking the third step. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. But I'm required to do something first. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. Both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. I have to follow the dictates, and then I'm going to presently live. I have to turn it over to a new employer and then keep close to him, and he'll provide everything that I need. So if I don't know what my purpose is, I'm not going to get fed. I'm not going to find what I need. I'm not going to have the promises come true, because the purpose always precedes provision in the big book. And this tradition, more than any other, tells me to stay focused on that purpose. Example of how you can get off purpose even in business. I did a film on the railroad industry. In the 30s and 40s, the railroads transported 80% of all the people and cargo in the United States. But by the 1960s, they were less than 10%, and most of them were failing. What was their purpose? They forgot. Their purpose was not to be in the railroad business. Their purpose was transportation. And it was that simple. Had they kept their eyes on the fact that in My job is to help transport people, to carry them someplace. Then they would have looked at trucks and planes and the other ways that took over from them. But instead they got caught up by not changing, by not adapting. We do that in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have websites in most states now, and for a while people didn't think we should go to websites. But they had the same discussion in the beginning about how much they should use the phone. When something new comes along, our purpose is to carry the message. It's not the details, it's the message that's important. And that's the reason that, you know, Disney's Family Entertainment, they recently took some kind of PR splash and decided they were going to get involved in gay rights, which was totally apart from their business plan. And it came back to bite them. And some of that feedback came back, and their chairman of the board was let go or moved out of his position not too long ago. The sixth tradition an A group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the A name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. The way that was explained to me is, mind your own business. I have had at least 14 or 15 emails from one particular fellow who was trying to correct an AA, quote, club in the Atlanta area recently. He got in touch with GSO. He got in touch with Intergroup. He called me. And it finally got to the point where he had argued so much with these people that were running the clubhouse that they got a restraining order and he can't go there anymore. He thought he was following the traditions. He thought he was helping AA. But we're not affiliated with clubs. We're not affiliated with any of them. The wisdom of our traditions is that we don't get involved in outside activities. And on a personal level, mind my own business means that in order to stay good friends with my dad, I have to stay away from politics because he and I totally disagree on politics. But it's a simple thing. And I found after I got sober and after I went to a great length to make amends to him and I was accepted, my dad was this man that I had alienated myself from, knocked down when I got back from Vietnam to go out to get a drink. When I got sober, it was like the prodigal son. My dad opened up, and he was one of the first people to welcome me back. But there was still a lot of injury done, and I had to prove myself, and I called him every Sunday, and I talked to him every week, and I went to visit him. And when I would go, I would try to do things that weren't so self-centered, things that were loving, and not to go to get, but to go to be part of the family. And to fit in and not have to be the main thing. And I finally built that relationship up over a period of time. And I was 15 years sober and sitting and talking to him, and all of a sudden we're in a huge argument. And he's screaming and yelling because of politics. So that's none of my business. What he does, who he votes for, any of that, that's his business. I had to learn that there are things that I just leave alone. When I first got married to Barbara, I wanted to help control her. I wanted to control her program. So I was kind of, it was me versus her sponsor. I had to learn to mind my own business and get out of the business of her. And by doing that, she started listening to her sponsor, and it gives us a lot of freedom. She goes her way when we have a problem. I go my way. I talk to my sponsor. She talks to her sponsor. We stay married. Most important, when I'm doing things that aren't my business, I'm wasting time and energy that I could be using to do God's will. This is the most important awakening for me in probably the last 5 years, is that I have spent a lot of time and energy doing things that really didn't amount to anything when I could have been spending my time, my energy, and gaining financial freedom to do what God wanted me to do. And when I do what God wants me to do, I get rewarded. Which brings us to the money tradition. Number 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. As a result of all the things that happened to me in 2.5 years ago, I ended up heavily in debt in a house that I couldn't afford. And here's what I did with over 25 years of sobriety. Because I thought it was important for me to keep that house, there were 2 months in a row where I took money that was paid to me by clients so that I could pay my suppliers and instead paid my house payment because I thought it was a temporary fix and that my billing would go up and I'd make more money within a couple of months. And it quickly became obvious, two things quickly became obvious. One, that wasn't true. It wasn't going to get better in a hurry. And secondly, I was being absolutely dishonest. So with over 25 years sobriety, I had to go to my suppliers and apologize and tell them the reason I was late in paying them was because I had done this. I had made my house payment before paying them. They forgave me. I paid them, and I decided that I would stop making the house payments. I'm the one, if I can't pay my bills, that has to take the consequences, not somebody else. I'm in good stead with the people that I was working with and continue to stay in business. I finally ended up losing that house at a loss. And God moved us to a house where we're out in the country. I pay 15% of what we were paying. I've got 11 acres, a lake, and a big house. That's what I was looking for. But if I had continued holding on to that and doing it my way, not being self-supporting because I'm not using my money, I'm using their money. Because that money that comes into me, if I don't pay my bills each month promptly and on time, I'm borrowing or stealing their money to live off of. So if you're getting by floating or conning or using, then that's not self-support. And that's what I was doing. Now, I had stopped the other stuff, floating credit cards and stuff, years and years ago. But I thought in this particular case, this is okay to do it. It's never okay to do it. And as a result, I did end up getting out of that house. But if I had continued making the payments, I would have lost those suppliers and I would have gone out of business. So I would have lost the very income that allows us to live where we are now. We just read the promises that God's our employer and that he'll provide if we're... So if I'm not self-supporting, then the area in which I need to look is back at following God's guidance. He's my employer. How am I keep close to him, performing his work well? And it comes back to God's will. What am I doing? I give you two lessons that I learned from people that I worked with in sponsorship. One was a guy who was extremely talented, and he did the same thing. And I learned this lesson because this was probably 18, 19 years ago. The guy had a couple of years sobriety. He'd had a theatrical production which he had single-handedly run, and it didn't work well for him, and all his investment money had gone down the drain, and so he owed now either the investors $200,000 or, in his mind, what he wanted to do was go to each one of the people that he owed the $200,000 to and get them to transfer that over into a new production. It was obvious to me and a couple other people that if he did that, he'd be conning them and he'd be in worse shape. So I suggested that he go to all of them, based on what my sponsors had taught me, and that he agreed that he would pay them over a period of time and just take a job. And he did that. Most of them forgave him. And within 3 years, he was paid up. The guy has 20 years sobriety now. He's a wonderful member of the fellowship. He's happily married, and he's financially solvent. And I should have learned that from him, but it came back to bite me. This is where we need this. I did the same thing myself 2 years ago. On the other hand, I sponsor a young man, or did sponsor a young man, and he never could pay his bills. He still owes a group and his own some money up here. And he also had problems with his father because it was over finances, and he'd never been self-supporting with his father. And we prayed about it because it was a tough deal for him. And we prayed about how can he get back with his father on one hand, and secondly, how can he get to the position where he can start paying his bills. And Father's Day came up. And he called me and told me he wasn't going to call. I said, have you called your father? He said, no, I'm not calling him because he sent me a nasty letter not long ago. I said, what did he send you the letter for? He said, well, he's just angry because I haven't paid him what I owe him. I said, well, I don't blame him. But he's your father, and your job is to honor your father. So call him and thank him for all that he's done for you. Because he made that one phone call, this is what God opened up for him. God arranged, his father was so touched by the fact that he had called and thanked him because that wasn't the way this fellow normally handled things, that he said, look, I'm getting ready to retire. Why don't you come up here, and we'll work over the next year, and you can take over my business, and that'll give you a good substantial income, and we can spend some time together. Now, God had obviously, I've never seen a clearer solution to prayer than this, where God had obviously said, okay, we're going to build the relationship with your father, and we're going to help you become self-supporting at the same time and pay off all your bills. And this young man went off to this place, and we talked about it before he went, that he was going to have to be disciplined and let somebody else kind of manage his money and live with two or three people until he could get his bills paid off. And he went up there, and once he got up there and got away from sponsorship, he decided he'd do it his way. I got a phone call about a week ago where his father's now suing him. He's lost the relationship with his father, and people all over the place are looking for him because he did not practice self-support. With self-support comes freedom. If I don't owe anybody anything, that doesn't, whatever, whoever I owe, owns me. If I don't owe anybody anything, I'm free to do whatever God asks me to do. The eighth tradition is Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. On a personal level, this is all about humility. It's telling me to do what I can, but get help when I need it. I know when I need help with plumbing or electrical or things like that. But I don't always know otherwise. Last night I mentioned a guy I sponsored when Barbara and I were married for 3 years who fired me because of the way I was treating Barbara in public. I didn't respect her very well. I was condescending to her sometimes. I would show my anger because I was disappointed. So we had to go to outside counseling. You know, I was embarrassed about that. But when we went to counseling, we found out how to communicate with each other. And we went to somebody who was familiar with the fellowship and the 12 steps and the 12 traditions and helped us. We've been married 20 years, so it worked. So the question here is, and it's easy enough in AA, we do 12, if it's a 12-step call, we go because that's what we're good at. If it's paperwork or publishing, we have outside people that do it. But I practice the same thing in my personal life. The ninth step is AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. And the way that was explained to me is just keep it simple. It goes with our slogan. We don't need too much organization. You know, we talk about government bureaucracy that has too much organization. The Department of Agriculture now employs 50 people in Washington for every farmer. Really, they do. For every one farmer, there are 50 people working at the Department of Agriculture. I just moved, and the toughest thing about moving was spending 10.5 hours on the phone with Southern Bell because now I have to talk to one place for DSL, one place for the home phone, and one place for the business line. And they sent people from both out there. They put in two jacks, charged me $1,000, got the billing messed up, and one of the lines didn't work at all. So I've spent 10.5 hours talking with the whole bureaucracy of Bell South over that. So I see it when other people do it. But I didn't realize that I was doing. I used to be real anal about planning trips. I would plan a trip, and I'd have everything outlined. And I'd plan a trip, and this is after I got back with my parents, and we'd have a family trip. And the hotels and the restaurants and the sites and everything I had everything running on a schedule. What we ended up doing when we go on these trips, because I'd organized it and over-organized it, is everybody was always tired because we were always barely getting to things. What was the purpose? And this goes back to unity and to following my purpose. The purpose of the trip was for us to get together in fellowship and relax and enjoy each other and see a few things. I had to learn not to organize too much. Or I have to learn not to keep it simple, not to give people too much information. When I'm standing in line at the dry cleaners with four people behind me waiting to drop their clothes off, they don't want to hear how I got that stain on my pants. They just want me to give it to the guy, get out of there. Tenth tradition. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name. I'll never be drawn into public controversy. Put it simply, everybody has an opinion, but focus on the purpose. That gets back to what I was just talking about. the problem with my dad with politics, the problem with, I'll tell you, there's a great scene in The Right Stuff, which is another film about astronauts that was done, and it's a scene where John Glenn gets into it with the rest of the astronauts because it was his opinion that they shouldn't be messing with any of the girls, and John was a faithful husband. And in truth, I do know part of that story, that almost tore them apart because there was judgment and because of the opinions they got in the middle of it. But their purpose was to form a tight group. And once they dropped that, they moved on, and you saw it in the film. But of more importance, there's a fellow named Sonny, who Al has mentioned to you guys, who helped Al and I stay sober. And Sonny got a divorce when he was 15 years sober. And everybody took sides. And everybody had opinions about who was wrong. And I cannot name anybody who did more 12-step work for Alcoholics Anonymous and helped more people get sober and helped to take more people to meetings than Sonny W. up in Louisville. And he was a wonderful, wonderful man. And from that time until now, and Sonny's got 30 years sobriety, Sonny has only occasionally gone to AA meetings. Whatever happened dramatically affected him because he was rejected by so many people who sided with his wife in that divorce. And that's where opinions get us off track. Not just as AA, but individually. The 11th tradition is our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And what that's saying is actions speak louder than hype. Right now, with all the spin masters, with everybody that comes out, with all of the stuff that goes on, if you turn on Fox, CNN, everything, it's nothing but even the news is hype anymore. And people don't trust. I saw something on AOL the other day where they do those little plug-in, and they'll get 200,000 people. And 80% of the people did not feel like any of the media was credible because of all the hype. There were a group of alcoholics that all came out back in the early 70s, and they were all celebrities, and they all claimed that they were recovered alcoholics, and the majority of them got drunk. If I'm trying to help an alcoholic, the things I have to pay attention to are the things where I walk into that singular store and start raising my voice to that woman because I'm angry about what happened to my phone. Because if people see me acting like an ass or people see me not, there's no program in the world I know of where people are more forgiving. But if I'm behaving in a way that doesn't lend a newcomer to want what I have, then I'm turning him away from Alcoholics Anonymous just as much as those four people that sat in that group in Maryland that sat and did nothing but whine and tell how their pills weren't working and all of that. So my actions speak louder. And the final tradition is anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. As simply put as it can be, it's God gets the credit always. Before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not know any real person that was in AA. I'd seen Days of Wine and Roses. I'd seen Lost Weekend. Lost Weekend, by the way, was written by a fellow who tried AA. It didn't work, so he got drunk. And the film reflects that. J.P. Miller, who wrote Days of Wine and Roses, was written by a member who got sober, and it reflects that. And I saw that. And I would see these articles in the newspaper where there would be people with their faces blacked out, and they'd only give their first names. So I knew there were people out there, but I didn't have any celebrities or people to find fault with. So I wasn't thinking that those people were leaders in AA. I just knew that there was something out there that worked. But this God gets the credit thing works in everything you do. I can't think of anything that I do in my work, in my family, or any place else where it's not better for us to give the credit to God than it is to take it ourselves. And that is really all I've got to share, but I just wanted to share a little bit different spin on it, and I want to give a challenge to people here. We have almost no meetings on traditions in the Atlanta area. When I was brought up in AA in Louisville, Kentucky, this 12 and 12 was the book that we used along with the big book in my home group. And we, every 24 weeks, changed. We do 12 steps, 12 traditions. So these have always been here, part of what I was taught, part of teaching me how to. They give me something to go back to when I can't figure out how to handle a situation at work, how to handle a situation with an employee, how to handle a situation in my personal life. And every meeting that I go to that's a discussion meeting, I hear people talking about all the problems they've got in terms of relationships or financial or anything else, and there's nothing that I hear that wouldn't be answered by either their own personal recovery or in these traditions, and yet they don't look for them. So my challenge would be for each of you to go and support or start some kind of meeting where you at least discuss the traditions once a month, and if not, more often. Because there's more at stake to it. First of all, it opens up a whole new dimension for your sobriety because it teaches you how to get along in life. But secondly, there's more at stake. If we don't do this, then AA may not be here well into the future, and there's some new people here that may be going to meetings that are very denigrated. And I say that because if we fail from within. And all you have to do is pick up, I'm on the Grapevine Committee, and I go to the General Service Conference, and I'm going to voice this. But I picked up a grapevine recently that had a picture of a kiosk like this, or a podium, that had AA and NA on it at the same time. And we're talking about singleness of purpose. And I also had one edition earlier, there was an article in there written by a woman about her spiritual experience, where she had had a spiritual awakening, and she's just so glad that she didn't get thrown off the track by all this evangelical mumbo-jumbo, and that she'd found her goddess, and she found two of them at a pagan gathering, and she went on to describe this pagan gathering. The best way for us to ruin this fellowship is by getting involved with agendas of trying to, and right now, for some reason, it seems to be popular to mention all kinds of religions other than Judeo-Christian in the fellowship, and it's okay, and we say that's okay. That's not okay. We say God of our understanding, higher power, God of my understanding. It's whatever God you pick. But if I say God of my understanding, and I say, and I don't describe anything else, you get the message without me confusing you and turning you away. This is as simple as working with a newcomer, and you're sitting there talking about how much you support a certain team, and that guy supports another team, and because of that, he's turned away. Whatever we do here should be to unify, to be, bring people in. And the real gift of this, just like I learned how to be comfortable talking to somebody and being intimate with somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous long before I could do it out there. And I learned these traditions about our groups long before I learned how to do them in my relationships. But if you will practice them in here and carry them to meetings and get people interested in this as part of our way of life, then the blessing will be that they'll carry into all of your other areas, and you'll receive the blessings. Thank you.